Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Health Tech Pigeon podcast brought to you by the team at SOMX. I'm Hugh Penson, and today I'm also joined by Jessica Sommerove, also from SOMX. Jess, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. It has been, we say this every week, it's been a long week. Looking forward to the bank holiday. There's been a lot going on, a lot coming up. But yeah, I'm delighted to be here and breaking down the health tech news as we do every single week. How's your week been?
My week has been equally busy, I think, and looking forward to what is a bank holiday weekend for us here. Yeah, we've got some great stories to chat about this week. Anything that you're particularly excited for?
As everyone knows, I'm always excited to see women's health stories. We've got a few in there this week, so that is great. Obviously, massive fangirl of fertility, so delighted to see that they've got a report going on. And some other interesting stories, Walmart, Necco Health, and coming back from the brink of bankruptcy, a miracle in the commercial world. So, yeah, very excited to talk about some of those this week.
Wonderful. Well, without further ado, on to our first story. So our first story today comes from Sifted. Daniel X Body Scanning Health Tech Necco Health is expanding to the UK. Necco Health, which obviously made a big splash last year when it raised a 60 million euro Series A led by Lakestar, and which has, of all people, Spotify's co-founder making his first foray into the health tech space backing it. Necco's product is a full body scanning system for broad and non-invasive health data collection, which the company wants to make quicker, more convenient, and more affordable. The news this week is that they are expanding. Yes, they're going to hit the UK's shores very soon. This is after more than 20,000 people have signed their waiting list in Sweden. 3,000 tests have been done since February. There's, I guess, a lot to discuss in here, but ultimately it's about the body scanning procedure, and which takes, that takes 10 to 15 minutes. It's followed by a consultation with a doctor. Necco says its scanner uses over 70 sensors to collect 50 million data points and can, for instance, detect tiny changes that could help doctors detect diseases like skin cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and other metabolic syndromes earlier. Jess, you've had a look at this. What are your thoughts on this? What's your view on the body scanning tech finally being available in the UK?
So I'm really excited about this story. And actually, I was lucky enough to get some insider information at a dinner that I went to a couple of weeks ago. I won't reveal my sources, but this was definitely one of the topics of conversation. And basically, I was told that this launch was coming soon in the summer. So I don't know, in terms of the actual scanning technology itself, like where that stands from a regulatory perspective. I assume, and I need to go look more into Necco Health, exactly what they're doing and how they're doing it and the technologies they're using. But my assumption would be that they're using existing technologies that maybe do have some regulatory credence, and bringing together multiple different technologies to create this kind of full body scanning approach. When I was having this conversation, I was really surprised by a couple of things. The first was that what I consider to be quite a low price point. So when you pay privately, for example, to go for an MRI scan, you're probably looking in the region of a minimum of £500, probably between £500 to £800, £1,000. And that's obviously, you know, different if you go through insurance. But if you were self-paying, that's how much you'd be looking at. Now, to me, is it 230 euros? Doesn't seem like a huge amount of money. And I think it's super interesting. Like, I'd be keen to understand a bit more about their business model and basically how they make those costs stack up. And I imagine that obviously they stack up better at scale. But for me, I think there's something interesting about how, you know, it's not an insignificant amount of money. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's not like going and picking up a newspaper super cheap and cost effective. But there's something interesting about lowering the bar to access, which means that rather than it being super, super wealthy people, there are people who are kind of middle of the road on like comfortable incomes who perhaps would be more likely to consider something like this if they had a niggle and they wanted maybe a quicker answer, where they might perhaps therefore go and pay you know, 230 euros, which frankly is less than a nice hotel in London. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, becomes much more affordable. So I think there's that. I think it's then interesting in the context that, you know, what does this mean potentially for an NHS partnership? Like, would there be any possibility of an NHS partnership if there is a more cost-effective service like this that's able to maybe help reduce the burden on waiting lists for scans and diagnoses and that kind of thing? You know, we know that skin cancer, for example, diagnoses, that waiting lists, that's a real issue, that's a particular challenge. Cancer diagnosis waiting list, for example, that is a huge issue. So bringing in something like this that could be more cost effective, is there therefore a model that could be useful as an adjunct or as an overflow for the NHS? Maybe it's for certain types of patients, certain conditions or therapy areas, but I'd be interested to see if there is something cost effective that could happen to help relieve that pressure. But the other thing that was really, really interesting to me is the person I was talking to was saying, actually, I'm not that excited about the technology. And for good reason. She said the technology is amazing. It's doing incredible things. But actually, what is most exciting is that this is the way that healthcare should be delivered in terms of the way that the consultation happens, the way the information is presented, the way that the clinician engages with the patient, how that conversation happens. And it becomes an experience, and it's really focused on helping the person to understand and interpret what those results mean, providing that in lots of different formats to help interrogate that information. And what I took away from that conversation was this is entirely rethinking and reframing that interaction in the way that we do consultations. Because I guess when you're the Spotify founder, and don't get me wrong, I don't expect that he's come in and like created this entire product and process and service on his own from scratch. There's lots of other people. But when you're coming from outside of an industry into it, I guess you're not biased by lots of preconceptions about how things should happen. And maybe you're actually influenced by the way that things happen in other areas of your life and, you know, other things that perhaps you've done. And don't get me wrong, that comes with some drawbacks. We talk a lot about, you know, it's really important to have clinical input, understand your users, work really closely with those who are using products and services to make sure you're getting it right. But it strikes me, and I don't know because I haven't used it yet, and maybe one day I will, you know, I'd be interested to, albeit slightly scared. There is something really refreshing about, you know, entirely rethinking what that service and process can look like and that interaction of a person with a healthcare service. I'm really breaking that down to be something that is useful and valuable and does go some way to educating, informing and empowering a patient out the other side. And now obviously, like, you know, I talk about the NHS and that kind of thing, and you would need to have some kind of follow-on pathway, you know, for people where there was something spotted, you know, that the scan is only one part of it. But I think that, you know, there could be something interesting in this. And I don't think it will happen fast, particularly from an NHS perspective. I think that we know anything the NHS takes a very long time to come to fruition. And I don't even know that is on the roadmap. You know, I'm wishing, keeping my fingers crossed. But I think that it's going to be very exciting for the UK market. But I would love to understand a little bit more about the technology and the regulatory and compliance parameters around it, because we know that varies from market to market. And I think, you know, safety has to really be at the forefront here. And, you know, I have to say that having that conversation, it was something that really gave me confidence. I'm sometimes very critical of providers who give patients information without like fully explaining it to them and giving them the so what and here's what you should do. But I was excited because it sounded like they really had thought that piece through. And I would love to see, regardless of what happens with Necco Health and the service that they provide, like what we can learn from the way that they and companies like them engage with patients and customers, I guess, and how we can apply that to reshaping the future of healthcare in a way that serves clinicians, patients, and the system much better. Hugh, are you going to go for a full body scan?
maybe we'll see. It'd certainly be a lot cheaper than some scans, wouldn't it? I think a lot of what you just said raises some really interesting questions for me as well, which is, as you mentioned, it's €250 or so for the scan. It takes 10 to 15 minutes and is followed by a clinician. And I think it's so critical, isn't it, to make sure that you're not just going for a scan and being sent away with all of your results and told to interpret it how you will. And that there is that follow-on pathway. There is that explanation that helps you interpret and understand the results. I'm really interested to know, is the consultation with the clinician included for that €250 fee, or, is there extras on top? I mean, it feels like it's very affordable at that, because private consultations can cost, upwards of that fee just to speak to someone for 10 minutes. So, including that with a rapid scan and giving you the information you need to interpret that, it could be really powerful. And I think if it did include all of those things for the money, I'd be very interested. And I can see, again, how this could be great for the NHS, as you said, but also as a potential employer perk, and an employer benefits perk, is something that employers offer to their staff as a sort of annual regular check-in. I think it also raises another interesting piece as well, a slightly more general one, which is, for a long time, the idea of this the sort of preemptive body scanning approach and full-on annual health check has been met with some scepticism, as if it is that plaything of the rich to just go and get these checkups done. And there are some segments of the analysis which would say, oh, it's a, it up till now, it's been a waste of money. And I think, as you say, it's really making this accessible to a much wider market. I guess I'd love to hear from some of the skeptics of body scanning to see whether this, making it cheaper, making it more affordable, making it more convenient, ensuring that we've got all the pathways, brings that into something that we should be recommending, that we should be doing on a regular basis, having that full body scan to understand, catch things early, particularly as we move to a sort of more focusing on preventative rather than, catching things further down the line.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And in my mind, there are two types of people that it would serve in the first instance before we really get too deep into the preventative side. And my understanding is that the scan, that price does include the consultation after, because the consultation after is important. I imagine, as with any private service, there are add-ons and upsells and all of that kind of thing. There always is. However, so the two kinds of people I think that this will be most interesting to is, of course, the more like biohacker type people, the people who are already very body conscious, who are already looking to optimize their health, they're already probably expending income on these types of things, whether it's a full body scan, whether it's IV drips, whether it's, regular consultations with a particular specialist, it's a nutritional supplement, whatever it is, that it's people who are already kind of invested in this stuff. I actually don't necessarily think that, if certainly in the first instance, you would see a huge spike, and this really is based on no data, it's an assumption, you would see a particularly big spike of people kind of in the middle who are just a bit curious. I think it's people who have vested interests but are healthy. I think the other side of the camp is, and I'm sure she won't mind me saying this, but it's people like my sister, for example, who's had migraines for 10 years. She has never had an MRI scan. She has finally been referred to to be put on the waiting list for a consultant, which is 2 years long, but she's on a waiting list to be put on the waiting list. And she's been waiting to be put on the waiting list for 4 months already. And it's incredibly debilitating, experiencing migraines for a week at a time, not being able to work, basically not being able to leave bed, never having had an MRI scan, in part because A, it's really expensive, but also then once you have that scan, what do you do with it? like, how do you interpret it? You're just, you know, Joe Public looking at a image on a screen that really doesn't mean a great deal to you. And then you're back to probably Googling and seeing if you can compare like for like. Had there been something like this that was available, she, I'm sure, would have probably leapt at the chance because, you know, again, like, particularly when you're in pain, what is 230 euros when you do have, you know, some money to spare, or if it is a trade-off against something else, like, it's not as much money to find. And so I think what you will see is probably people who have had a niggle, have been experiencing ill health, but have been on a waiting list for a really long time, and actually getting private healthcare has just not been an option because it's either super expensive or, you know, going down an insurance route, particularly with a chronic condition. So my sister, for example, is not able to get support through health insurance because it's a long-standing condition. That means that her only option is self-pay. So something like this could give her some answers in half an hour. And it means that people are going to, their quality of life will hopefully improve far quicker because they're going to have answers far quicker. And they're not waiting and going through that diagnosis odyssey. That diagnosis odyssey is not taking as long because they're kind of, it's accelerated. They're getting answers much more quickly. So I actually don't necessarily think that you'll have a big influx of people who are kind of pretty healthy, just kind of going in for interest to maybe benchmark and then it finding something unexpected. I think it will be people who already have an inkling that something's not quite right and they want to find out more about it, and it's an accessible way to do that. I think over time that trend may grow, and I do think that from a prevention perspective there's something super interesting about benchmarking. And, you know, we talk about benchmarking of brain health with technologies that like Mindspan are using to, you know, map your brain and map your brain function and track that over time, and having a benchmark to do that is a similar approach. So I do see a future and a world where we move to that, but I think that because of where we are with the level of chronic conditions, the state of the health service, I actually think that that will be kind of a slower burn. I think it will and could serve people who need help just much more early, and therefore hopefully get the help they need far quicker. So, you know, I'm the eternal optimist here. I'll just say I've not interrogated some of the really important things. And I do think that, you know, it is a good question to ask. Like, that isn't a lot of money. So how does their business model stack up? How, you know, I assume they're probably not profitable. They're still a very young company. But, you know, what are the numbers that they need to see in order to make that profitable? How many scans do they need to be doing? How many locations do they need to have? They obviously will have other commercial models aside from the B2C. You know, maybe they would look to work with corporates, as you said, Hugh, from a, you know, workplace perk, or insurers, for example. Maybe insurers offer it as a perk, you know, for people signing up. Or indeed they do it, it's obligatory when you apply for insurance, so that insurers can kind of risk assess you. Which would, I actually don't think would be very good for anybody. But do you know what I mean? There's lots of commercial models, I think, that will be working simultaneously, but I'd be interested to understand what their kind of trajectory and plan is and how that all stacks up over the medium to long term. Because my big fear is that for something like this comes in, it makes a huge difference to people, and then actually commercially it isn't viable and it closes down, and then people are left without an option again. And that's never nice to see. So yeah, I would like to think that they've done that deep thinking and planning for lots of economic eventualities and various different commercial approaches, obviously across different markets, to make sure that it really is a viable option for the long term.
Certainly one to watch, isn't it? And from the size of the waiting list in Sweden, I'm not sure we're going to see it necessarily answer any of some of the thornier challenges of waiting lists and access anytime super quickly. But fingers crossed, and absolutely we'll keep an eye on it. And my guess is this won't be the last time it pops up in Pigeon and on the podcast.
Well, this is just a shout out to the Necro Health team that if you want us to do an exclusive, come down there, try it out once you've launched, hit the Health Tech Pigeon team up. We are the people for the job.
We are. On to our next story. So our next story comes to us from Walmart, of all places. And that is the news that after 5 years, Walmart Health and Walmart Health Virtual Care are shutting down after the supermarket, US supermarket giant decided that ultimately healthcare is not a sustainable business model for them. That means that 51 health centers across 5 US states will shut down, and the entire virtual care offering will do as well. In a statement, Walmart said that this is a difficult decision and, like others, the challenging reimbursement environment and escalating operating costs create a lack of profitability that make the care business unsustainable for us at this time. There are obviously a number of initiatives in place to make sure that the impact of the shuttering on customers is reduced as much as possible, but ultimately the company joins a long list of corporates that have entered the healthcare space with varying levels of experience beforehand and found it was not profitable or sustainable to continue. Jess, I mean, I know you've had a look at this in some detail and read up on it. What are your thoughts here? What's happened?
I think, to be honest, it's just incredibly sad. If not, you know, potentially predictable, as you say, it's the latest in a long line of big corporate businesses failing to truly crack healthcare. And again, you know, it was an interesting proposition, bringing healthcare to a place where people already are. We talk about that quite a lot, I think, is something that's really important, like rather than trying to bring people to you, go to them. And I love that about the way that Walmart were operating their kind of healthcare services. But I think, well, I guess a couple of things. First and foremost, it goes to show that it's a tough old world out there at the moment, and that everyone is finding it difficult. No one is immune from the challenges, but it also goes to show that you don't scale too quickly, and you have to have a commercial model that stacks up. And I think that actually you have to go on a really slow burn to know whether or not your commercial model will truly stack up. But unfortunately, that doesn't work in the corporate world, whether you're a VC-funded company or whether you are a public company with shareholders. Returns need to happen, and they can't take too long. And obviously, you know, there are funds that don't look for returns and for maybe 10 years, and you know, that's great. But for the most part, most, whether you're a shareholder, whether you're a VC, you're looking for a much quicker return. And I guess it's just disappointing that a company like Walmart, we've seen it with Amazon, we've seen it with so many others, that with all the resources that they have, do better. It makes me wonder how it gets to the point where it's operating at such scale, and it's at that point that you realize it's not working. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate the economy is a massive factor in a lot of these things, but you know, it's not an insignificant number of services that they're closing down. It's not an insignificant number of people who are potentially facing, you know, loss of income, a loss of job and employment, people facing, you know, the prospect of having to look somewhere else for health support. And it strikes me that, you know, there may have been indicators earlier on that perhaps were missed and would have allowed for perhaps earlier intervention and reconfiguration, rethinking. And again, making lots and lots of assumptions based on one article that doesn't have loads of information in it. And of course, it's the article that Walmart themselves have put out. So there is a narrative there, and you know, the absence of detail is intentional. I totally get that, but it's sad, but I think, well, there's no but. It's sad, and I want to see big corporate companies doing better. I don't think it's good enough with the resources and capabilities they have to create something that's commercially viable and to identify much quicker when something isn't working.
It's a big question as well, isn't it? Because as part of this announcement, they've reassured people that Walmart Pharmacy will continue and Walmart Vision Centers will continue. And you've got so essentially the pharmacists and the opticians will stay while the healthcare offering goes. And among that pharmacy offering, you know, they are offering immunizations, screening, specialty pharmacy medication and care, what they describe as a wide variety of health screenings. And I wonder if it is a piece about, as much as corporates should be doing better, I wonder if there is a brand association here. I mean, the corporate involvement in healthcare, which is obviously very significant in America, with the way the system it works, you know, it's a much more sort of financial payer based system. But do people want to go to Amazon or Walmart or whoever else to have serious medical care and advice? And on the flip side, should healthcare be looked at as a, you know, a fully corporate industry? Is it something that, you know, if you're looking at your profit margins of, you know, your retail sales and everything alongside that, it, you know, at some point you're going to have to make critical decisions like this. Should big corporates be going into this from the beginning? Or should the kind of more high street services like pharmacy and opticians be where they draw the line?
I guess though that, like, it's about bringing care out into the community, isn't it? And it's about access. And I get what you're saying. I also think there's maybe a data thing that, like, it's different in the US, of course, to how it is here. I think people would probably be asking the same questions if Asda was providing health services and wondering what Asda might be doing with their data, how that was being used. But again, I think it's about providing it's making care accessible to people in a space where they already are. And I think that that's something that health systems don't do super well. And, you know, clearly a space that Walmart and others have tried to fill relatively unsuccessfully. But I do think that there is a line that around, like, care that shouldn't perhaps be provided through these kinds of services. And I don't know enough about the actual healthcare that was provided through these clinics. But I think there is something about considering how much we can push out to the community, full stop, no matter who's doing it. And I do think that probably in the US and like payer markets and insurance markets, there is a different mindset to, I guess, like, brand in relation to healthcare providers, because ultimately all healthcare providers have brand. They are a commercial entity. They are selling a service to people in a very different way to how they are over here in the UK and maybe other markets in Europe as well. So I think it's an interesting moral question. And yeah, I don't know the answer, because I don't know how I would feel about going to Asda or Tesco to get healthcare support. But then I guess if you're seeing a doctor, you're seeing a doctor. I don't know. Don't have an easy answer to that one. Sorry, Hugh.
I don't think there are any easy answers to that one. Probably the question is, how much commoditization or overt commoditization can we accept in healthcare? It's an interesting question that I don't think anyone's got an answer for. So our next story comes to us from Fertility Health, which has just released its Reproductive Report 2024. The second annual report takes real-world data from over 325,000 women and identifies a number of health information gaps and understanding in the research around women's health that absolutely are pretty shocking when it comes to understanding of different conditions. Data reveals that 42% of women trying to conceive don't know when their fertile window is. 63% of women are stressed, which fertility data shows correlates with hormone imbalance, physical symptoms, and time spent trying to conceive. And 22% of women trying to conceive continue to vape. Just a number of just three of a wide number of findings in the report that is far too long to go through in and capture all the details in here. But ultimately, the fertility team believe this will help close a number of the gaps that exist based on extensive research and survey of their users. Jess, I know you've had a look at the report and you've got some thoughts. What's your views on this?
Well, firstly, two things that are not actually relevant to the report, but I'm going to say them anyway. Well, actually, no, one of them is relevant to the report. Well done, fertility team. This is awesome. Like, incredible aggregation of a huge amount of data, over 325,000 women. That's pretty spectacular to be able to use the data. I'm one of those. So, yeah, I've contributed to health research. Isn't that cool? But it's a phenomenal number of women to have shared their data and to be able to do some, you know, really meaningful analysis on it. The second point, which is the irrelevant, which is that I'm totally inappropriately dressed for this story today, because last week I rocked up to the podcast wearing my fertility I'm not overreacting sweatshirt and got a lovely compliment from Sinead from Boo Biome. And, you know, whilst I did love the compliment, I wish I'd saved it for this week. It would have been way more relevant. The thing that really stood out to me in this is that they've covered two big topics. The first is mental health and the second is menopause. And starting with the menopause, I think this is really exciting to see because so I've heard about a lot of interest broadly from the health space and research space around, you know, trying to conceive and that sort of thing, much less about menopause. And I think even as I sit here today, to me, the menopause as a woman who understands their body pretty well, the menopause seems like this mythical thing. I wouldn't even know where to begin. Like, I know probably like three basic facts about it. I know that, you know, your perimenopausal when you start experiencing symptoms, when you have hormone changes and your body changes. And the menopause is actually once you've been, it's been 12 months since you've had a bleed. That's really the extent of my knowledge. And, you know, arguably that's kind of on me. I could go and educate myself. I also know and understand that it's such an individual process, and actually the best information you can probably get is from people in your family who have gone through that process to understand what their experience is. But then being able to see the aggregation of this huge amount of data from women who have been through that process, what they experienced, when they experienced it, how they experienced it, how they responded to treatments, what treatments they used, that is really exciting because it starts to lift the veil and demystify something that actually feels quite scary, I would say. And I think that comes along with a lot of taboo because there is such a lack of information around it. And I think there is something very taboo about women aging and getting older anyway. And I think that menopause is very much wrapped up in that. So to be able to kind of debunk some of that with facts and data to help people understand in the broad, I think is amazing because it's going to educate them, but also it might inform some of the conversations that would be useful for them to have with people in their own family to understand a little bit more accurately what their roadmap and what their journey might look like. So I think it's awesome that they've chosen to focus around that. And I think the other thing that they focus around is mental health. And I find that incredibly interesting too, because what it shows me is that we are a very stressed generation of people. And when you look at the fact that fertility is declining, mental health is on the rise, as you say, Hugh, stress is linked to fertility. You know, I know that there are lots of factors surrounding fertility, lots and lots and lots of those, and stress is not the only one. But anecdotally, I even hear from my friends as they are on their journey to trying to conceive that actually, I think we talked about this last week, the mental health element of trying to conceive is so hard. It's really challenging. And like, you're kind of going through the motions, you're going through this process, and the pressure you feel to conceive this child is causing so much stress that actually that can be a blocker to you actually conceiving anyway. And you can feel like you're your own worst enemy in that respect. And it's really hard to kind of get a grasp on that and to catch yourself and not get stressed in an already stressful situation. Layer on top of that all the life stresses that you're already feeling, the cost of living crisis, my energy bills are increasing, my food bill is increasing, can we afford to have a child now? Can we afford to have a child if our energy bill goes up even more, or if the interest rate goes up on our mortgage and we need to remortgage, or actually we have to move into another rental property? Like, can we have the space? All of those things, like, you know, some of that is actually relevant to obviously having a child, but there's so much stress in the world at the moment. It's not encouraging to see the data, but I think it's very confronting to see that data. And I think it speaks to a much broader issue, which is that mental health needs to be tackled for the future of the world, for so many reasons, but not least for us to be able to bring, you know, a new generation into the world and a healthy generation as well. You know, what is our stress therefore doing to the children that we have and the children that we raise as they go through, you know, the nature and nurture experience? Like, how is that impacting them? So I think it is incredibly interesting to see that they've really focused on this and, you know, tried to dig into understanding the real impact of mental health on the menstrual cycle, on your hormones. And yeah, like you said, 63% of people said they were either somewhat stressed or completely stressed and overwhelmed. And, you know, again, I would mark myself amongst those people. I actually, you know, it's not a good thing, but I consider myself to thrive under stress, but I know that that's not healthy in the long term. You know, riding on adrenaline and cortisol and all of those things that actually, you know, it's not a safe or healthy state of being, particularly, you know, if you're trying to conceive. But I think one of the really exciting things about this, it talks about how people are beginning to think more about how they prepare for conception. And I guess fertility is a really great first step, or like an early step in that journey. And, you know, I guess seeking out information for how they get better prepared for that. And again, anecdotally, I see that in practice with the number of conversations around my peers and friends around contraception and when is the right point to come off it. And that started maybe even as long as 10 years ago, where people are thinking, not necessarily even for fertility, but trying to figure out like what is right for my body, and what is going to allow me to make the decisions that I want to make around my future and my fertility at the right time, and what is going to put me in the best place to do that, so that if I decide that I do want a child, I'm in the strongest position to be able to do that. So I think that's encouraging that people are having conversations with themselves and maybe others earlier and seeking out that information. And I don't know how far that goes to counter the stress effect, or maybe it increases it because people are stressing about this earlier and for longer, and what they need to be doing. I'm not really sure, but you know, where we know that there's a massive data drought around women's health and experience of health, I think it's this kind of thing should really be celebrated, and is really, really incredible to see, because it's also no mean feat to go through the data of 320 plus thousand women and analyze that and figure out exactly what that means and draw insight from it. And also, you know, you have to acknowledge the fact that the reason, so they're obviously fertility customers, and some of that data is going to tell a certain story, because by and large you're going to fertility for a certain reason, whether it's because you're exploring you know, your fertility for the future because you're thinking about trying to conceive, or because you have experienced symptoms or problems, or maybe it's both. So I think that, you know, obviously there is something to be said for how that skews data in a certain way. But by and large, I actually just think that the fact that we have this data is truly incredible. And the analysis is just so insightful. So I'm really looking forward to digging into it in a lot more detail.
I don't have a huge amount to add on top of that, but I think I think the fact that this research exists is, you know, is testament to the work that Hertility is doing, both as a company and to close some of these research gaps. You mentioned that a lot of women learn about these things from conversations they have within their own family. And I think critically having this research is a great, those conversations are not going to be the same for every family. The quality of the advice, the quality of the learnings from those conversations, it's informal, it's very personal, it's very, quite often very casual. And having this data out there so that women, might not have been able to learn as much from other family members, might not have been able to get the advice they needed from healthcare providers. Having this research out there to say, A, you're not alone, and B, this is common. This is, these links have been explicitly made, I think will give people a lot of confidence in being able to make those decisions themselves. I'm also hoping that all of this research and a lot of this is taken forward into healthcare and healthcare advice, and that there are more structured junctures to provide some of this information at the right times to help people thinking about these decisions, thinking about conceiving, thinking about perimenopause, thinking about menopause and going through this, so that that advice is out there. And particularly, you talked about the stress side. It's having that link between mental health and fertility so clearly made. I think a lot of us, who have talked about mental health with clinicians who aren't mental health specialists will know that there's probably a bit of a unwillingness to make that link explicitly. Well, it's accepted, but they're not going to be specialists. And I think having that link so clearly made is going to be so valuable for healthcare providers to have those conversations a bit more openly and a bit more honestly and a bit more clearly, to make sure that everyone has the information they need and is given the right advice at the right time as well. So I think, as you say, absolutely essential report.
You make a really good point though, actually, because this information, this data is amazing for women and not just women, like everyone, to understand women's health, fertility and all of that kind of thing. But my wish is that we see insights from this kind of research and data being carried into the health system, because I think that's often where we fall down. And I think that this kind of research and data needs to inform the way that we support women better. And I don't know this because I've not been through the process. I'm not there, but there's something really interesting about, as you said, so we're drawing connections between mental health, stress, and the impact on fertility. Is part of the process when someone goes to their GP, and bear in mind you have to have been trying for 12 months before you get any support from the health system. When someone goes to their GP and they say that they've been trying to conceive for 12 months, Is mental health and referral onto specific, perhaps it's CBT or talking therapy or something like that, is there a specific pathway for people who are clearly presenting as having, not necessarily a mental health condition, but mental health is perhaps an element in their fertility journey? But then also, I think, sorry, I'm spitballing here a little bit. I think there's something interesting about that, because two things. First of all, we've got a shortage of mental health support, service and care anyway. So that's really difficult. It goes to show that we need much more funding and support in that space. I think there's something really interesting about making sure that there's mental health services specifically for people who are going on this journey and who are struggling to conceive. The challenge will be, though, there is this long-standing narrative around women's experience of health, around the psychosomatics of that, around it's just in your head. And I think therefore balancing this information around the fact that your mental health and your stress levels is having an impact on your fertility. I know that if I was in that position and I went to a doctor and a doctor said, I think that stress is playing a part here and let's start with, some talking therapy, I'd probably feel a bit pissed off and a bit fobbed off. And that's probably my own internal narrative too, because I would know that there's merit in doing that, but I would also probably feel a bit fobbed off and be like, no, but I want tests. I want some kind of intervention. I want more help than that. Like, surely you can do more than that. But actually, that is an appropriate intervention in and of itself, potentially. So it's a really complex thing to navigate because of the damage that we've done around women's health and how we approach that in a health system, and being able to support women in an empathic way that feels genuine and authentic, rather than, well, they've just told me it's in my head again. So it presents, you know, some interesting dilemmas, but I do think that it's clear we need to get better at supporting people on this journey and thinking more broadly about the support that people need before perhaps having invasive procedures and that kind of thing.
Completely. So yeah, it's going to be a difficult balance to manage, but I think data like this is critical to finding those paths forward. Well, that was the Health Tech Pigeon podcast. Thank you everybody for listening. You can find all the stories we've spoken about this week, as well as some of the best jobs, podcasts and events in the newsletter at healthtechpigeon.com. Make sure to sign up. And this is a quick flag that we're looking forward to seeing everyone next week at the Somix Health Tech Talks. If we're not able to catch you, we'll see you on the podcast next week. Thanks again.